And welcome everybody to another update of Smart Money Circle. With us today is a very special guest, Julie Kutasoff, Portfolio Manager, Senior Research Analyst at Kayne Anderson Rudnick Investment Management, with approximately firm-wide $55 billion in assets under management. Julie, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Julie, I always like to begin. Can you tell us your story and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. Well, I grew up far away from Los Angeles in Moscow, Russia. Grew up there and started my education actually here. My college degree, I started in computer science, but always had a dream of getting my college degree here in the US. So I came here, was fortunate to be accepted at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, started in computer science. Always loved kind of the math part of it, but not writing code. So we actually had a couple of very charismatic accounting professors at UCLA. I know charismatic is not usually used when describing accounting, but those were great professors. So after a year, I changed my major to business economics with a minor in accounting. Mm-hmm. And graduated. And after college, spent 3 years in financial audit practice of what was then one of the big six accounting firms, Arthur Andersen. Mm-hmm. Got my CPA and went to business school. Again, was fortunate to be accepted at Harvard Business School.
Wonderful.
Graduated in 2001, actually joined Kayne Anderson Rudnick right after that. Basically discovered investment management while at business school. always loved numbers that tell a story, so to speak. So I was really, again, fortunate to be accepted to a great firm, to join a great firm, and still am enjoying what I do as much as I did 20 years ago, which is great.
That's wonderful. What a great story. So you started off computer science, then you moved to accounting, and then business, and when you got your MBA, you decided to go into investment management because of the fact that you like numbers, but numbers that tell a story. So I'm assuming this is going to be the next question. Can you tell us a little about your investment strategy? I'm curious to see how the numbers tell a story, if it plays into it.
Yeah, sure. And it's actually a great question when it comes to the philosophy of the firm, because we really are investors in companies that we describe them as highest quality companies. I'll talk in a second about the philosophy of the firm, but here numbers really do tell a story. So when we screen for our companies, we can't screen for high quality, right? There is no criteria like that. We screen for numbers, right? We screen, in our case, for consistent earnings growth and solid, consistent profitability. Consistency is very important to us. We screen for solid balance sheets and solid free cash flow generation. Those are numbers, right? But at the end of the day, the way that we evaluate our businesses is through fundamental analysis of what we call business models. And that's where numbers really tell a story. So the screening process that I just described, right? This is just the first step. And then what we really do in order to understand if this company fits our high quality profile is go deep into those numbers, analyze them. And what I mentioned, business model, identify at least one of so-called business models associated with those numbers, meaning that what protects this business, what allows for those consistent superior results in the past to be sustainable in the future. That's really where we differentiate ourselves. That's what we really do well as investors, able to identify those superior characteristics of the business. In fact, we like to think of ourselves more as investors in businesses than investors in stocks. So again, good question, because really in our case, numbers tell a very specific story about the superior characteristics of that particular business.
So can you give us an example of what those criteria would look like, or some of those points would look like?
Sure, sure. So, very simple one would be something like a brand, right? It can be a consumer brand, can be a commercial brand. Give you an example of a consumer brand, which I'm sure most of your listeners recognize, something like WD-40, for example, right? This is the brand that you can tell that a brand is strong when there are copycats out there with names such as WD-39 or something like that. And there really I don't think you've seen a commercial for WD-40 anytime recently, right? Because it's just, you know, the brand speaks for itself. So brand, a strong brand, but how do you test for the strength of the brand? You can have a very recognizable, highly recognizable brand, but it doesn't give you much unless you have pricing power associated with that. So that's how we test for the strength of the brand. Pricing power, which is certainly vital in this environment where we have high input cost inflation, right? And companies needing to pass through those input costs to end customers, right? So brand. Another one is switching, high switching costs. A good example of that will be any vertical software company, right? So we all know how difficult it is to switch out of a software that you've installed, you know, that's become a part of your workflow. And unless you are completely dissatisfied with that, you will not be willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, you know, companies such as, you know, one of our, you know, the name actually that precedes me, and I've been with the firm 20 years, were investors in Jack Henry & Associates. This is a financial technology company serving banks and credit unions. And if you look back at 2008, 2009, you would not know that there was a financial crisis back then, because unless that bank closed its doors or maybe sold to another bank that used a different provider, you would still need to use those services, right? The back office software services. And other examples are network effect. You know, the example that you probably everyone would recognize, eBay, right? The more fragmented the universe of buyers and sellers, kind of the more value added the network effect, the provider of the more value add is for the company that connects us to fragmented markets, the more value it provides.
Right.
You know, in this case, I'm just using eBay as an example, obviously not a holding of ours, but various business models. But it's interesting, you can have more than one associated with a name. I mentioned Jack Henry and switching costs there, but I would argue that it's also a very strong brand among bankers that I've always, you know, talking to, that I'm always talking to. Those bankers recognize this brand as a very reputable brand. They're willing, again, to pay a premium for that service that I mentioned. How do you test for the strength of the brand? You're willing to pay a premium for it.
Understood. So it's kind of like an Apple or a Tesla where you pay up for an iPhone opposed to a different phone because you want that brand experience. And then once you, even on a computer, a Mac, once you, or Windows, once you have a Windows people or Windows people and Mac people and Mac people, they don't really want to switch. Is that another way of explaining the point that you're making?
Yeah, that's very close. So exactly. So you have these business models that allow these companies to be protected competitively. Yeah. That's what we're looking for in our companies, competitive protection.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to management, our companies, just the nature of the businesses that we're investing in, this high quality businesses, strong free cash flow generation. Mm-hmm. One great problem that they all have is allocating that excess cash, right? So when we look at the management team, we are looking for discipline, capital allocation discipline. So in the case of WD-40, for example, using it as an example, knowing that your brand strength is your key
asset,
your key treasure, so to speak, your asset, and not venturing outside of it through acquisitions just for the sake of growth. So mm-hmm. what they're doing is leveraging the brand in some of the new products targeted at some of the commercial markets.
Mm-hmm.
But they know very well that if that reinvestment opportunity is limited, they would rather return cash to shareholders in buybacks and dividends. So that's what a quality company is for us. Strong business model coupled with very disciplined management team.
Interesting. So you said that numbers tell a story. How do you quantify that from the number standpoint, the brand equity or the customer not wanting to switch? I understand that from a, you know, an experiential, you experience it, but how do you actually look at the numbers and make decisions that way?
So when, as I mentioned, we screen for consistent, superior, financial results, be it earnings growth or profitability. Balance sheet is really a strong balance sheet is usually the outcome of strong free cash flow generation ability, that self-funding ability.
Got it.
So when we screen for those companies, we look at how those companies performed in the most challenging economic periods. We're going back to the recessionary periods. But again, no matter how well those companies did, no matter how sustainable, no matter how consistent those results are, unless we're able to identify the business model behind those results, we will not be investors in the stocks. Because again, we need to be sure that those results are sustainable into the future.
Understood. So you run the fundamental screens, you have a universe, and then you filter that down based on the criteria that you're looking for that you just outlined. Is that correct?
Exactly. And what's great about this universe operating in the small mid-cap space, that you're constantly having new names coming into the universe. So sometimes we observe those for years, just kind of making sure that they really belong there in terms of the high quality profile. But again, new companies coming in, spin-offs from large corporations, we love those. Companies that were private for a long time, you know, just had a couple of those recently coming into the market, very long history as a private entity. So constant flow of new ideas into the space. And again, as you mentioned, having that universe of our names that in our case, this discipline, that philosophy that we have allows us to be very focused on what really fits us and what doesn't.
Makes sense. And then next question for you, Julie, is how do you handle risk and what mistakes do you see people make with respect to risk management?
Sure, sure. So in our case, as you may imagine, we handle risk mostly first and foremost at the company level. So again, by investing in this high quality businesses, minimizing business risk, minimizing financial risk, be it P&L risk or balance sheet risk, right? That's how we manage risk first and foremost. We run focused portfolios, 25 to 35 names. So we stay very close to our companies. And as portfolio managers, which is rather unique about us, of course our analysts take the lead, but we as portfolio managers stay as close to our companies. And because these are focused portfolios, that allows us to do so, stay very close to our companies and being able hopefully to identify any structural changes before they are reflected in the stock price. So one thing that I would say how people, you know, many others, as you know very well, manage risk, which is not our cup of tea, is by that, you know, running those 100, you know, plus stock portfolios, kind of nothing can hurt too much. We have, as I mentioned, very concentrated, high conviction type of portfolios. We don't believe in those highly diversified sort of 100 plus portfolios. This is not our strategy. That's one, I think, one way that you can think that you're managing risk when you are in fact not really managing it, by thinking that you're minimizing risk by limiting your exposures in every single name. I think, you know, just in general, not being as close, right, to the story that you're investing in, kind of having the thesis that you're not able to monitor consistently for changes, because we're living in the world that is constantly changing, so nothing is stagnant. Again, we're able to do that by having very limited set of names in the portfolios. It's hard to do when you have so many names in this in strategy.
So talk to me a little bit, Julie, if you don't mind, about the disconnect between stock price and the business. So you're a fundamental investor, you're looking for sound undervalued stock or companies or businesses, you take investments in those businesses, hopefully they have a moat around them, they have a, you know, good numbers, good cash flow, good balance sheets. I had a guest on the other day, she said balance sheets should balance. In other words, they should be balanced. And then the stock price. So if you have a stock price that goes down 10, 20, 30, 40%, or some bear market happens or steep corrections, do you have stops in place? Like some people say, okay, well, I'm going to get out 10% below my entry, or do you look to buy more as the stock goes down because it's getting cheaper? You know, how do you handle that disconnect between the price of the stock and then your valuation or your assumptions based on future value going forward?
Sure. So of course, as I mentioned, we strive to identify any structural changes before they reflect on the stock price, but we do make mistakes like everyone else. So when we have a very rough, you know, let's call it 20% decline in absence of the market, where we go through a process we call position review. Basically, what it means is going back to the investment thesis, mm-hmm. line by line, original investment thesis. And we do go back to the investment thesis constantly, at least quarterly. But when this happens, we go back very explicitly to the investment thesis. And if that investment thesis is intact, that just means this is an opportunity to add to the name.
Okay.
If there is any deterioration in that investment thesis, that usually means we need to exit. But what's great about us is our companies continue to be highly profitable. They continue to have that strong balance sheet, right? Even though there may be, you know, some issues that we're talking about. So there is never kind of that run for the exits in our case. We make the decision to exit. We may want to have a better exit point. Valuation wise to do that, but we will exit if the thesis is no longer valid or has partially deteriorated. In general, I would say that our companies in the high quality small mid-cap space are often overlooked by investors, and that's what actually allows us to have that very nice value proposition, very attractive value proposition of achieving the returns that are superior to the asset class, our benchmarks, but with a risk, much lower risk, which is the risk that is kind of more akin to that of the market of the S&P 500. What allows us to do that is that we believe that we play in a less efficient subsegment of the market, that small mid-cap, high quality subsegment. The reason is that it's overlooked by three groups, actually. It's overlooked by traditional conservative investor who's looking for blue chip large cap companies as shying away from the small mid cap space, and reasonably so, understandably so, it's a riskier space. We are overlooked, the segment is overlooked by a traditional small cap investor who is looking for more aggressive growth. Our companies are not the fastest growers, they're the most consistent growers.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also often overlooked, the segment is all often overlooked and very commonly overlooked by Wall Street.
Yeah.
Our companies are self-funding entities, they don't require capital, Wall Street capital to grow. So unless they grow to a certain size where they no longer can be ignored, they are often ignored. So and we love that. This is the inefficiency that we explore. So back to your question, sometimes that really plays really in our favor in terms of being able to get into those names when they're not valued in line with their fundamentals.
Understood. So it's not a stock price based decision to exit, it's a fundamental business decision based to exit for a profitable trade and or for a losing trade, is that correct?
You're right. So we, if the stock valuation is such that is calling for a trim, we would do that, absolutely. But we usually will not sell if the fundamentals are intact.
Gotcha. Okay. What are some timeless lessons, Julie, you've learned along the way that you'd like to share with the audience?
So I guess one of them is that common saying, right, is different this time around. It's, you know, it's always looking that way, right?
Yeah, very this time is different, yeah.
You know, it's a common sort of common situation to face when every time the scenario is a little bit different, and it certainly is very tempting to think that way. I would caution against that. There are definitely some structural changes occurring, and some of them certainly took place even more recently after the pandemic. But at the end of the day, the statement of this is different this time around is usually wrong.
Right.
So I think that lesson you learn when you go through as an investor, when you, with your experience as an investor, you go through several cycles. I think for someone who is just starting out, it's probably good to have that knowledge, you know, just from someone who has been through the cycles before that.
I love that. And then what about some timeless mistakes you see people make? How do you avoid it?
Yeah, I think the biggest mistake is not defining your investment philosophy clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And even for those who do define the investment philosophy clearly, not sticking to it.
Yeah, that's
so great. I'm thinking about us, right? Our high quality investment philosophy. There were periods, very prolonged periods, and actually more recently, since that recovery, post-pandemic recovery, that were not favorable for quality. So for someone, it may be very tempting, could be very tempting. And the interest rate environment was, for example, such that certainly high leverage was not punished and, still not being punished, right? Despite right. the most recent increases. But it's very tempting for some to modify the investment strategy based on what's taking place in the outside world, sort of this kind of environment that they're finding themselves in. And I would again caution against that. If you believe in your investment philosophy, if you really know what you are, who you are as an investor, you have to stick to this. You have to stick to what you're doing, no matter what the environment is out there.
I love that. So, Julie, what would be the best piece of advice you'd like to share with the audience?
So I guess, again, know who you are as an investor. If your philosophy is really the one that warrants the thought process that you've put into it, it will reward you, or let's call it over the market cycle.
Yeah.
So stick to it. The investment world is a vast ocean. You'll be lost, you'll be lost without a compass in that ocean. So have that North Star and stick to it again. That's, I think, the best advice I can give, especially in this volatile world that we're living in right now.
Well, I love this time is not different. Make sure you have an investment philosophy that works for you and stick with it. It's been some really, really good, some timeless advice you share with us. Julie, thank you so much for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.